Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
Hey, Adam.
How are you?
We're back in the shop.
We are. It's been a while.
I feel like we just did this a minute or two ago, but it has been a while since
you've
the last
been traveling.
Time we were in here.
I've been traveling. There's been a lot of flying around the country.
Since I last saw you, I saw a tux.
Yes.
That it's had, I don't think you're going to get the deposit back on it.
No. We abused some tuxes in the course of shooting an episode of Mythbusters. We went to Monument Valley, Utah, specifically to Moab.
That's where all the John Ford Westerns were shot, right? Or a lot of them.
Everything was shot there.
Yeah.
And
we
took
shot
some great
where
panoramas.
We filmed
phone.
Where Thelma and Louise pulled their car up.
Really?
Yeah. The ranger helping us had just spent months working with Gore Verbinski and Johnny Depp on the Lone Ranger film with Armie Hammer.
Fantastic.
That seems like the right place to shoot
exactly.
that.
Exactly. We filmed a really, really, really stunning episode of Mythbusters here. I actually enjoyed the fact that I tweeted a picture of me wearing a tux holding a golf club at the top of this impossibly beautiful canyon.
Perfectly normal thing.
And no one could guess what the hell we were filming. I said, nothing in the picture has anything to do with the myth. And of the several hundred responses, one of them turns out was correct.
Fantastic.
I'm always a little like, oh, they got it.
Infinite monkeys.
Right, yeah.
Not that the listeners are monkeys,
no.
But you know. Hamlet. You got Hamlet there. This one's a fast turn compared to normal. Usually it takes a while between when you shoot stuff and when it airs.
Yeah, it's usually at least 3 or 4 months of post-production on every episode that we deliver to our Beyond Productions in Sydney, Australia. Yes, Mythbusters is produced in Sydney, Australia. I know
good day,
several
mate.
People
wow,
listening
it's,
just
it's
went, really?
It's not an all-American production.
No. In fact, I think Mythbusters owes a lot of its sense of humor to the Australian sense of humor.
Well, they're
the guys who are cutting it, right?
It's the only show that works with that format in America.
And it's the very much the British and the Australians would call it taking the piss out. Always needling anybody in your vicinity because that's how you show affection.
Yeah.
Mythbusters has definitely grown up with that. But we were in Monument Valley. We filmed a really terrific episode of Mythbusters. It's going to be aired in conjunction with a special that Discovery's airing early this summer, which means we are right up against the wire on filming this.
Wow.
One.
So
we're delivering the footage
normal.
On the last possible. We're finishing up one more sequence tomorrow, and we're delivering the footage on the last possible day that post-production can get it and still work with it.
Typically, how long for like one episode? How long can that be spread out across?
In terms of the filming?
Yeah.
Usually we try and get it within a couple of weeks. I know that Cary Grant and Tori's team shoots more out of order than we do.
Mm.
And that's, I think, just by dint of the way they prefer to work. So we try and wrap up an episode within the 7 or 8 days that we've got allotted.
While it's fresh.
But sometimes we stretch things out. Sometimes we work on complicated builds. We want to make sure they go right. So we'll park them for a few months to make sure we got the research correct. We've got one in the hopper right now that's been going for a year. But we've got so much invested on the front end.
Yeah.
You know, at some point, I think in about 6 months, we're going to have to really hustle to get the back end and make it work.
Cool.
Very cool.
So while you were playing around in the desert, you know, doing your little thing.
Yes.
Norm and I went to space.
You didn't go quite to space.
As close to space as either of us will probably get
to
go.
We went to the place that the people who go to space go before they go to the place that takes them to space.
That's not Russia.
Right. So before they're in Russia, they go to Houston, Texas, Johnson Space Center.
Yes.
Home of Mission Control, among other
the
things.
The real Mission Control.
The real one. And we got to see all sorts of awesome stuff at Mission Control.
The quote is, Houston, we've had a problem.
Yeah. Tom Hanks took some liberties.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, not Houston, we have a problem.
Oh, Houston, we've had a problem.
Outside Mission Control on the wall in about 6-inch letters, there is the quote. They don't say, it wasn't even there. It was at the Saturn Rocket Park across the street. They don't say, hey, Tom Hanks messed up the quote. It's just there for you to take note of and appreciate.
I don't think that anyone at NASA, I really would be surprised if anyone at NASA is bothered by Hanks getting that quote slightly off from what it really was, given the amount of love and attention and beautiful narratives Hanks has rained down via NASA over the past
I would say you're
years.
Right. They like Tom Hanks.
So we shot a bunch of stuff, but it was fun to talk about behind the scenes, and we were talking to Bill Foster, who runs one of the ground controllers, flight controllers
yeah.
for
He's a ground
NASA.
Controller.
He runs ground control. He is ground control. you know, from the, wow. from the song.
Can you imagine meeting him?
We did meet him.
Ground control. Yeah, no, but yeah. like if you met him in a random bar, what do you do?
Tom.
I'm ground control. Oh, really? Yeah, that's funny. No, I'm ground control.
Yeah. But he told a story of when they were producing Apollo 13, how the set designers, production designers, gave him the tour around the facility, and he also got to visit the sets
yeah.
and see how authentic they were. To you know, the equipment doesn't get updated that frequently, and they're in the middle of
yeah.
doing that. But you know, Ron Howard and his production team did a good job.
Really? And they said it was perfect?
It was near perfect, but the one they embellished it a little bit, like lighting.
Yeah.
They did some fancy backlighting to make it more dramatic.
Oh, sure.
That, yeah.
Everyone looks a little better in the movies.
The thing I didn't realize is that the mission control that was used, because they have multiple mission controls. It's not like there's just one,
right.
which makes sense. But the one that they used for the Apollo 11 landing is a National Historic Place, so it's preserved as it was.
Oh, right. I remember
during
I just
the Apollo
read about
missions.
That recently. Yeah.
yeah.
That was just... A floor above where yeah. we're in the current mission.
We didn't go. We should have gone in there. But we also got to see next gen mission controls. So right now they have like LCDs jammed into the big blue stations that you right. that you know from movies. They painted them green at some point during the shuttle days.
Right.
But it's just like LCDs jammed into these places where CRTs used to be.
Right. So it burns cooler.
It's cooler in there, and they're not hooked up to mainframes or anything anymore. They're all hooked up to PCs, but it's not taking advantage of the form factors that we have available today. So they've designed this new thing called 21 MCC. Is that it?
It's for 21st century yeah.
Mission Control Center.
Oh,
And it looks like the set of 24. Basically,
it's like CTU in 24.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's all like flat panels on arms, and they hit buttons and stuff pops up, and it's really cool.
That's
so we
cool.
have that video coming.
Excellent.
Are
there cool snacks?
Yeah, we have.
Like, just like you push a button and like a you know.
Oh no food.
Out of
no
the
food.
No food in Mission Control.
Well, we don't know. Is
they
that...
were all drinking coffee and smoking in Apollo 13.
I'm going to go ahead and shut. This might surprise you, but they weren't allowed to smoke inside the building anymore at Mission Control.
Sometimes I pointed out to one of my kids recently. I was telling him about how I used to hang out after school and talk to my science teacher, and then I had this memory, and I said, "Actually, you should know this." It was so long ago that it was during lunch hour, and I'd visit my science teacher in the classroom. He'd be there grading papers and smoking.
Oh, yeah.
In the classroom.
Wow.
Where yeah. When I was
French
in high school, there was a smoker's lounge for seniors who smoked.
For senior
for yeah, seniors yeah. at school.
My high school, too.
Who smoked. Yeah. Like that, the smoking inside and changing light bulbs, two things that your kids are never going to have to learn how to do.
Oh, right. The LCD light bulb, LED
yeah.
light bulbs.
Yeah.
LCD light 100,000
years, 100,000 hours. That's every 20
the
years you change the bulbs.
The lamp will fail before the bulb does.
Most likely. So Norm interviewed one of the divers who works in the neutral buoyancy lab.
Oh, my God. The huge pool. The giant.
Second biggest pool in the world.
Where's the first one?
It's a river that they block off and has a roof over it.
Serious?
That's what he said. He said literally there's a river that they shut the doors, they make a pool indoors. But the NASA guys don't think that counts because they don't filter it.
I don't think that counts.
Like, yeah, I think it's bunk.
Well,
so
how big
is this pool?
This pool is like 100 by 200 by 40.
I think it's 100. It's even a little bit bigger than that. But yeah, it's so deep that when you stand on the edge, well, they have marks a foot back from the expansion joint. So you have to step back away from it because you kind of get vertigo when you look down into it. But it's so big and clear that you kind of you're not able to process how deep and clear it is. It looks like it's about 10 feet deep, 20 feet deep, and it's actually 40 feet deep. It kind of reminds me of the reactor vessel at the Reed reactor.
Right.
Like it's kind of super clear. So we talked to him about what it's like to dive in the pool because they have a whole support team with the astronauts when they're training for ISS. What else do we do, Norman?
They have special spacesuits that they wear for those.
No. We thought they did.
Really?
But it is just because...
Because they're custom made for each of them, so you might as well be wearing your...
They're not even custom made anymore. Because on the ISS, they don't ship a new one up each time an astronaut goes up or down.
Oh, now they've got the shell.
So small, medium, large.
Yeah, the shells are in small, medium, large. The pants are fixed sizes.
The gloves are
many more sizes. So you have your own set of gloves, and you have your own set of cooling underwear.
Because
they pad that out for each astronaut.
And the helmets
I've always wanted some of those gloves. Those are some of my favorite things.
We got to try them on.
Really?
It was really cool.
And helmets are one size fit all.
Yeah. The helmet, like, so looking at this thing up close in a way that I had never been able to before, I can really see how if you were even the slightest bit claustrophobic getting into the arm piece, because you come in from underneath through the waist and put your arms out, and it's all rigid.
Yeah.
So if you get in there and you start freaking out, it could be really bad.
Yeah, I could imagine. It is among the things I've learned on the show is that I am just in no way claustrophobic whatsoever.
Yeah. Huh.
I can sit through an MRI, no problem. I can sit through three of them in a row.
8 hours at a time.
Put me in a coffin and bury it. Oh, yeah. I'll be fine.
Just don't need to scratch your nose.
No. Yeah. I'm good with that stuff.
So we talked,
I would love to put on, that's my way of saying to NASA, who's listening.
Yeah.
I would love to put on one of those suits.
We kind of looked at him and there wasn't even the opportunity to ask. They didn't give you the opening to ask. Hey, can I try on the suit? We got to see from the diapers on up, though. They showed the whole thing.
That's
so
cool. You guys got some pictures.
We had pictures, video, the whole thing.
Yeah. But we're there primarily for food.
Hold on. We got to talk about the space shuttle first.
Oh.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Because my dream as a small child, you know, I had that book that had the fold-out thing in the inside that was the control panel of the space shuttle.
Yeah.
And I never thought I'd be able to climb up. When they retired them all, I thought my opportunity to get into a cockpit of a spaceship had gone from very, very low of a space shuttle, had gone from very, very small to gone when they retired them all. Because they're
right, but
they're closed for preservation
that,
and stuff.
You would think they'd strip out the cockpit?
Before they put them in the places, they took in the gigapans. And they did like the 400 megapixel images of the inside 360 panorama, so you could see it all. But then they're being preserved, so they seal them off, and you know it's limited access and all that.
But even with a limited access, I mean, you were saying you probably never get to space. But I would have to say that you guys, in your position as communicators, might be among the 7 billion people on Earth, on a shorter list of people who might get to space,
yes. I'm going to go ahead and tell you right now, if I had $60 million, I would spend $50 million for 2 weeks. No question.
So I have to tell you, when this... All right. So yeah, this won't mess up the auction. Right now, there's a freaking Mercury helmet on eBay.
And you collect helmets?
An actual Mercury helmet? Used? Yeah. Went to space?
It looks... I don't know if it's flown, but it's genuine.
Wow.
It's really genuine, or it's one of the best... It's the best copy I have ever seen. It's sitting currently at about $1,500.
Ooh.
I've put in a maximum bid of $1,000.
You're not sniping?
If I can't get it for that, then I don't deserve it.
Oh, my goodness.
But I want this.
So would you make the whole rest of the suit to go with it?
Well, I actually have an Etsy seamstress making me a pair of Mercury suits right now.
Nice.
I have two helmets worth of parts upstairs. But if I could obtain
the real thing,
forget about it.
Could have had John Glenn or Gus Grissom or Alan Shepard, any of those guys. Even Wally Shearer. We'd take Wally Shearer.
Absolutely. Anyway.
So we got to go on the high liability tour of the shuttle trainer.
What's the high liability tour?
Well, you know how when you go in a submarine and you're getting the tour of the submarine, you get to the ladder that goes up to the conning tower and they say, oh, no, I'm sorry. We can't let you go up there. It's too dangerous. We got to go up there.
Nice!
The PR lady had never been up there. And so to explain, this is the mock... There's a whole facility called Building 9 in Houston, which is a giant warehouse of training vehicles. And they have everything from the rovers to the robots to...
Canada Arm.
Yep, Canada Arm, a life-size mock-up of the Canada Arm, to the interior of the International Space Station, and also the shuttle cockpit. Even though the shuttle cockpit is no longer being used.
Right.
It's still in the facility because they're not retiring that yet.
We just assumed it was cheaper to leave it there than to actually remove it from the place and store it someplace
right.
else.
So whereas last year when we went to New York, we saw the Enterprise, which was the flight test.
And
never went to space, but you have to get 10 feet close to it, but you don't actually go inside.
Right.
And the director of the museum there at the Intrepid in New York said that he had brought like astronauts inside because who had actually flown to space. And so it's a very short list. Here we get to go in and the two decks of the space shuttle. So it is a very, very cramped space. And I can't believe they at one point had 8 people in there.
Yeah, you've probably seen like an Apollo capsule at museums and stuff over the years. It seems like it's maybe 3 times the interior volume of that.
Wow.
And they packed 8 people.
And people would go up there for like
two weeks. I mean, I think the 2 week missions that had that many people typically were going to the space station. So once there was maybe 2 days that were cramped and then it opened up.
Can you imagine if someone's got serious BO?
Oh, I think you just... Well, there's no running water. You have sponge baths.
Wet naps.
Wow. That's rough.
So... So I didn't appreciate how small it was.
You can bring it back.
Oh, it's got to be like the worst locker room smell ever.
I will tell you that we did an episode which will air this coming Thanksgiving about boarding airplanes, and we had some flight attendants from an airline help us out, and they were awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But I said So at the end of a flight, the cabin smells pretty bad, right? Because like the pressurization, everyone's farting and
farts and sweat.
She says one of their hazing tricks they do to newbies who are bringing in the gangway to the plane is they go, now when you open the door, you have to be holding on to it. And they really, they get engineer it so that the person's face is right there where the seal is broken. So they crack the door and get this face full of 200 people's farts.
Concentrated fart smell.
Oh, that's an occupational hazard.
She says it's nasty every flight. Of course, you can't smell it on the flight because you've just been part of it.
Oh, I want to know.
I know.
So,
wow, you want to bottle that up.
Oh.
Essence of
sell it at
cabin.
Spencer's. Yeah.
You could use your favorite fear, sweats, and farts while they're flying between.
Oh God, that's horrible.
Sorry. So it's smaller than you expect.
It's tiny.
Tiny.
It's tiny. I don't understand because the thing I realized after we got out is that when they get into it, it's vertical.
Right.
So it's on the launch pad, ready to go up. I don't know how you would have climbed into the seats, the launch seats.
Wow.
When it was in a vertical orientation. Like there, I had so many questions, and unfortunately there was nobody there that could answer them.
Oh.
So Norm and I just kind of farted around inside the inside the shuttle trainer for a little bit. But they had like the manuals for the flights and all that stuff. It was really neat.
Every switch.
Now the
amazing.
The real reason we were there though, we were there to do actual work instead of just fart around with NASA guys. Was food related.
Yes.
So we went. We brought David Chang from Momofuku and Tracy Desjardins, who you know from the omelet video, and
she's
San Francisco. Yeah, she's a friend. To maybe help make space food a little tastier.
It's that when that first came across, I don't even remember who thought of it. It just was such a great idea to get some of the best chefs in the world to take some of the renowned, not so awesome food. And I know that NASA's worked hard on it, but it's still hard to make really tasty stuff every day up there on the space station, to take those ingredients and put together something maybe more awesome.
So, but the pitch that we gave to NASA was basically, hey, or to the CSA actually, because we were working with them through Commander Hadfield, was that we wanted to do the Apollo 13 thing for space food. This is what you have.
Right. Yes.
Make the this circle donut fit into the square bread.
Right. Exactly.
And here's the protocol for how to put it all together.
Exactly. Yeah. So we did that. And as a through part of this, we got to see kind of the history of space food, which was really fascinating, all the way from like the tubes and cubes that they used for the for the Mercury and Gemini programs.
So did you actually end up trying a lot of this?
We didn't get to taste the old stuff because it's all 40
stuff.
They didn't want us to eat 40-year-old food. I don't know why.
Although Tracy was super excited because apparently the French.
Alan Ducasse.
Yes. They had canned food that was made by one of Tracy's employers.
Really?
Yeah. So Alan Ducasse, who's a famous French chef, had made canned ESA food. And it was like a duck pate and pureed celery. So it's the most French space food imaginable.
Awesome.
I love that pureed celery.
We got to taste a lot of space food. And
what was the best?
So there's two things to know is that there's no refrigeration on the space station.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So it has to be
space cold though.
Well, kind of, but not really. Oh. Only on the shade side.
Oh wow.
only in the vacuum on the shade side, and there is a module on ISS where you experiments where organic life and stuff is they're all exposed to the vacuum. It's on the Japanese module, but no, there's no space shuttle had refrigeration. ISS, because the power requirements would be too much.
Right.
So they're running off of like 4 megawatts or something like that. And with all the other stuff that goes on, it was too much of a load. They have a little bit of a chiller that you can put a thing of water in, and it'll make it cool so that after they finish working out, they can drink a cold beverage. But no refrigeration space. So it all has to be shelf stable, which means it has to survive at ambient room temperature for the length of time it takes to get there, and then 12 months afterwards, thereabouts. So
that's a rough requirement.
It's basically like MREs or freeze-dried.
Right.
Because they have water. They have plenty of water.
Right.
The freeze-dried stuff was surprisingly good for the most part. And we were there with chefs, so they were very into trying to mix different flavors and textures. And we tried a lot of the freeze-dried stuff that wasn't rehydrated, as well as some that had been rehydrated.
So on the ISS, the director of their food program they've concocted up about 200 different items that they send up, including different types of beverages and a mixture of the shelf-stable, the MRE stuff and the freeze-dried stuff. And we requested with the chefs sampling. So there was a whole part of that morning where Tracy, David, Will, and I stood around having packages heated up and filled with water and opening them and just tasting them, sometimes not heating them up,
right.
Sometimes not infusing them with water. And that was like the fun part of the day.
Yeah.
And it was really fun, these chefs who've had the best food in the world and make some of the best food in the world, just give their honest opinion off camera about, oh man, that's not bad. You know, oh, that's so gross.
Well, the thing that Dave said was that a lot of times the freeze-dried stuff really concentrates the flavor.
Yeah.
So like he uses freeze-dried strawberries, like the astronaut strawberries you get at the gift shop at every space center in the country, in ice cream to make it super strawberry flavored.
Nice.
And
that makes sense.
So like the freeze-dried asparagus, when you ate them dry, tasted like the most asparagusy asparagus you've ever tasted. Freeze-dried grits, likewise, very tasty and kind of like they almost tasted like rice cakes that actually tasted like something good instead of rice cakes.
So you asked what was the favorite thing. They had some barbecue brisket. That I would have eaten that all day long in elementary school, middle school.
Wow.
Yeah, like it would have been awesome. And that was a therm-stabilized food. So typically the therm-stabilized stuff was a little bit gnarlier than the freeze-dried stuff. And most of the proteins were therm-stabilized, not freeze-dried for obvious reasons.
What was the worst?
Well, there's like a three-way tie here, probably.
Really?
So there was this, it wasn't jerky because they have to watch sodium. So they have what I think was freeze-dried slices of roast beef that was one of the worst things I've ever tasted in my life. Like
it's just bloody.
Like I think pirates ate better food than that in the 1600s.
What was awful about it?
It had a bloody taste that wasn't appealing.
No.
But it also kind of tasted a little bit musty.
Like
there was a musty flavor in meat that you kind of don't
want.
It's
like you're eating a mummy.
And then the texture was also really bad. So it kind of broke apart in these weird chunks it was really bad. It was just it was one of those things like it didn't strike you. There were some other stuff that we had that struck you as bad more quickly. This, after about 20 seconds, both of the chefs were looking for someplace to spit because they were like, this is resetting my level for bad taste.
Now, Tracy told me about some freeze-dried shrimp.
That was the worst thing I've ever put in my mouth.
And you put a fair number of bad things in your mouth.
I have eaten a lot of awful. I've eaten testicles and all sorts of other horrible things over the years. The freeze-dried shrimp.
Not to get into a frat, right? But
just for culinary experience. I figure, you know, it's food. People eat this. Why not?
A lot of guys teabag. It's fine.
Yeah, no, they were detached.
Oh, okay, cool.
Thanks.
Sorry. So the freeze-dried shrimp was truly...
Well, the freeze-dried shrimp is an experience. I kind of want to get some and give them to people as a trap food. You put it in your mouth, and at first you're like, oh, it's not so bad. It tastes like shrimp. It's maybe a little hint of like fish flake.
To be
fish
fair,
food.
This is we ate it freeze-dried. We didn't infuse
it
with water.
We did not.
Oh.
Astronauts, actually, one of their favorite foods, they've told as feedback, is cocktail. Shrimp cocktails. And that is the freeze-dried shrimp with some, you know, with some cocktail
And when they
sauce.
Infuse it with water, do they put water in and then let it sit for an hour
so
or something?
Each of the packets has instructions. It says, put this much water in, and then they turn the dial on the machine on the station, and they tell whether to put it in hot or cold, and then how long to let it
hot
sit.
Hot or ambient.
Okay. Right. Hot or ambient, yeah.
And we ate it straight out of the package, freeze-dried.
So a lot of the pasta and stuff, because this had a little bit of, like, noodly fusilli pasta or something in there that you could kind of, that tasted nice freeze-dried.
Right.
The thing about the shrimp was it hit your mouth and it kind of exploded into a bunch of little tiny pieces. So you had this really strong, like, fish food flavor. It starts at the front of your mouth and kind of slowly encompasses your entire head. And then what happened is, like a spoonful of cinnamon, it just started absorbing all the moisture in your mouth.
Oh, no.
So it kept getting bigger and bigger. And the taste at the same time was getting somehow a little more stagnant and worse. So, like, it was like a 5-minute experience, and it was the kind of thing that you really wanted the most pungent tasting thing you could imagine to just kind of flush out of your head.
Tracy was telling me about watching all of you guys, like,
just the loss of moisture and the intensity of the fish food flavor was real bad. It was like a put Tabasco on your mouth to kind of get things going again.
That's
situation
hilarious.
Afterwards. So yeah, that and the tofu with hot mustard, which Dave ate on camera, or I think Tracy ate that on camera.
Oh, it was awful.
It was pretty bad. I can't imagine why you would want to eat that. And whether I guess in space where you can't go order in for pizza,
they're just
eventually.
Trying all sorts of, well, someone works at NASA. They're trying all sorts of different things.
Well, and right? as the director of the Space Food Services Lab, is that right? Maybe not.
One of those.
Yeah. She said that once they develop a recipe, then basically it's like, you know, they spend a ton of money on it and it's going to go.
Right.
And sometimes they have like dietary requirements for the astronauts. Like some of the astronauts, once they get to space, have to be on a low sodium diet.
Right.
So then stuff like the baked tofu.
Astronauts also are encouraged to walk through supermarkets and find things they like because they get a personal selection of food as well.
Did you find out any cool stuff about what personal items the astronauts have up there in terms of culinary?
So she said that pretty much every restaurant in the greater Houston area that has packets of sauce, those things get bundled up into Ziplocs and sent up to the station because they'll bring, whether it's the crappy taco sauce from Taco Bell,
right,
all the way up to like weird srirachas and stuff like that.
Oh,
that
nice.
Come in the pouches.
Yeah. I knew sriracha had to be up there.
I don't know that she didn't know that sriracha was.
I'll bet it is.
But Tracy found sriracha that you can buy in packets online, so we're going to make sure that they get some.
Brilliant.
For a future care package.
And the thing is that they swap out every 6 months. So there's actually leftover food in the pantries from like the previous crew. So astronauts will get sometimes leftovers. Oh man, someone didn't eat their Nutella or something.
Here's some Twinkies.
Right.
Yeah.
Twinkies?
I don't think they actually had Twinkies in space. The thing that we learned was that the thing that they get most excited about is fresh food. So when resupply missions come, the Progress or the Dragon, SpaceX Dragon or whatever, they'll load a relatively small amount, like one basically bag worth 7 or 8 kilos of apples and oranges and maybe sometimes like blueberries and stuff like that.
They just go nuts.
So for the Russian flights, the Russians are in charge of that. So it's a completely different set of fresh foods. For the U.S. flights, basically what they said is for the 2 weeks leading up to that, it's all the astronauts ask about is what have you put in the fresh food basket? And while the Russians are bringing like whole onions and raw garlic and stuff like that and just, you know, chomping into the raw onion, by the time it gets there, usually even the Americans are like, yeah, give me one of those onions. I'll totally take nom, nom, nom. So yeah, we ton of great stuff coming out of that. I can't wait to see it. We haven't seen it yet by the time.
Very exciting. It's I love talking to anyone who works at NASA. We've always had just the best relationship with them going down to NASA Ames. And like I said, I was so jealous you guys get to go down to Houston.
Even if you can't make it, they do tours if you don't live near Houston or Ames. Like people, we saw tour groups walking around and a lot of public areas. But if you know someone who works at NASA, what we found is that everyone we talk to, they could just talk and they're so into what they do.
That
is infectious.
Yeah.
And they have so much insight, and they have stories, and you know, even before we started shooting video, we just had this long conversations, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, I wish. I mean, I know sometimes it's difficult to get people to talk in a kind of off the cuff way when you aim a camera at them, and I think that the next time we get to go do something with NASA folks, I'm probably going to just roll the cameras the entire time, and then we'll have these massive, long, sprawling 40-minute conversations. So we just post and see people like.
Totally agree. I totally agree. I think that's a plan.
So I guess that's it. That's it. Yeah.
Nice
stuff
work.
On the site, stuff that you should come and look at on the site.
Yeah.
Norm's got photo galleries of the inside of the ISS mockup and
it's
the space station
cool.
mockup, both of which I like. Top five lifetime experiences. It's like birth of the child, inside the space shuttle trainer, getting married. No. Switch those slides.
Yeah. Careful.
It's really cool. Ton of great stuff. Two food videos. One with Tracy and Dave.
Yeah.
The Neutral Buoyancy Lab interview that Norm did was fantastic. A guy named Chris Hull, who was a commercial diver, and now they dive nitrox. So it's super interesting. We learned all sorts of cool details about how that actually, like the mechanics of how that works.
Oh, very cool.
That I'd never heard before.
Yeah.
And then we get to see the inside of a spacesuit. So, and try on gloves and put on helmets and all that stuff. It was super cool. So I guess that'll do it for us this week.
Yeah. Nice work.
Okay. See you guys
see you
next
guys
Tuesday
next
with another edition of Still Entitled.
Thanks for all your comments.
Bye.
Bye.